What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Emily Gould. Emily Gould is an author, novelist, and blogger who worked as an editor at Gawker. She's written several short stories and novels and is the co-owner with fellow writer Ruth Curry of the independent ebook store Emily Books. We discuss the rise and fall of Gawker, we discuss her time there, and we also discuss her rather infamous appearance on The Larry King Show that evening, hosted by Jimmy Kimmel, which we get into. And I thought it was a great discussion. Very much enjoyed it. Thank you, Emily, again for the time. If you want to find out more about Emily, you can reach her at emilygould.com. That's emilygould.com. And now I give you Emily Gould. Okay, I'm here with Emily Gould. Emily, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, Josh. It's great to be here.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. So much I want to discuss with you, Emily. I want to discuss your life, how you intersected with history, certainly Gawker, and everything else. But before we get there, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Oh, sure. Well, I guess I'm primarily a novelist. I like to think of myself as a novelist. But the way my career has worked out, similar to the way many novelists' careers have worked out, sort of like my novels are this self-indulgent, fun hobby, and then my other kinds of writing are how I make a living. So I started my career in book publishing in 2003, and I worked at Hyperion Books, which has since been subsumed into Disney Adult Publishing, but it's a publishing house that's owned by Disney, and I was the assistant to the editor-in-chief there for 3 years, learned a ton, and was at the point in my editorial work where I was starting to get, you know, to do my own deals. I was acquiring books. I advanced up the corporate ladder to assistant editor, which meant that I got my own office, no window, but still an office. And I then blew up my life and sabotaged this slow and steady rise up the rungs of, you know, something predictable and sane by starting to write an anonymous gossip column about book publishing that was published on a media gossip website called Gawker, which had been founded a couple of years earlier. It was still like a pretty small time operation, but was definitely a big deal among, you know, people who I knew in publishing, just my friends and I who were stuck in front of computers all day, answering our bosses' phones and filing their memos. It really broke up the day in an era before social media existed to be able to constantly refresh Gawker.com and get a little hit of, you know, mostly news items that took down people who weren't maybe our literal bosses, but were kind of like in the same category as our media overlord. So I went from writing that anonymous column to working at the website. I worked there for a year. I worked there starting in 2006 and ending in 2007. And after that, I wrote a book. I wrote a collection of essays. I sold the collection of essays by writing cover story for the New York Times Magazine called Exposed, that illustrated with these beautiful, beautiful, but like kind of slightly something photos of me sort of disheveled and sad looking in my bed with my laptop next to me, sort of giving off the vibe of I'm so sexy and yet so depressed. And that, you know, provoked a big reaction. It still does. Although when you read the article now, you just really see how I'm talking about things that were just entering the culture then that has since become so commonplace that we don't even have really like language for them anymore, which is, you know, it is what it is. And then I was sort of wandered in the wilderness for a little while. I was trying to freelance thing. I did yoga teacher training and I was temping and all kinds of stuff, trying to pay my rent without having a full-time job. And I eventually landed back in book publishing, and I started a project with my best friend where we founded a feminist publishing enterprise and ended up publishing some really great books that we're super proud of, called Emily Books, emilybooks.com, if you want to check it out. They'll keep the website up and running, but for now, we're not publishing any more original titles. We wound down the project, fortuitously, as it turned out, in March of 2020. And since then, I've been doing a lot more journalism, mostly for Vanity Fair and New York Magazine, and recently went on staff at New York Magazine, which is so great, and it feels like coming home to me, because it's actually where I got my start in terms of being paid to write anything. I was writing reviews of bars for Grub Street, which is part of New York Magazine, on the side when I was working as an editorial assistant, which I probably, I definitely spent more money going to the bars than I did from writing the reviews, but it was still, it made me feel like, you know, like I was like a little, wearing a little fedora with a press sticker on it, basically. Like, I'm doing the thing. I'm here in NYC practicing the art of journalism. So now I'm doing that again, not writing reviews and bars. Yet, sure. I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, my title is features writer. So I guess, you know, anything's fair game.
You never know. No, excellent, Emily. That's great.
And when I wrote two other novels. I forgot about my novels, even though I introduced myself as a novelist. Yeah, I wrote a novel called Friendship in 2014 and a novel called Perfect Tunes that came out in April of 2020, which you can imagine.
Like, quite the release date, huh?
I'm sorry to say on your podcast, but
that's
like,
okay.
You know, I have two little kids. They were much littler then, and I'm really looking forward to the part of releasing a book where you get to stay at least for one or two nights in a hotel by yourself.
Right.
So that didn't happen for me. And it continued to not happen for me for, you know, a couple of years.
Yeah. So, that's a shame.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I feel I want to call out just for our audience. Emily Book is an imprint of Coffee House Press, I believe, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In Minneapolis.
Yep. Which is where I'm at.
Figured from your zip code. I mean, area code.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Friend of mine's a writer for them named Andre Codrescu. He's a poet. Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Cool. Anyway, yeah. Sorry. Got ahead of myself there. No, thank you, Emily. I appreciate that. That was comprehensive. I love it.
maybe a little too comprehensive, but I did a lot of stuff. It was
no, you did. Absolutely.
It was 2 decades for old Emily Gould.
Absolutely. I love it. So getting back to Gawker then, you may have answered it in previously there, Emily, but I'm just curious, how would you describe Gawker in its inception to somebody that's never heard of it before?
Oh, it's really hard to describe Gawker to somebody who's never heard of it before, actually. I've had to a bunch of times, usually with, like, my parents' friends. I usually describe it as an old-fashioned, Gawker at its inception, as sort of an old-fashioned gossip column, but perpetually updated and available online. So just something that everyone's familiar with, a concentration of a gossip column, like Russian Malloy, you know, Cindy Adams type of thing. But yeah, it's just kind of brought into what was then the modern world in the early 2000s.
Which feels like several lifetimes ago already, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's that internet meme that really resonates with me. And also, I think maybe a lot of other people who are around my age, like, you know, late 30s, early 40s, which is that 2005 and 1995 are both 10 years ago.
Huh. Oh, that depresses me.
But that's just, it's not true, obviously, because
right.
That's not how time works, but it, but it is how it feels to me.
Totally.
You know? Yeah. Like when you look at what day the song came out and you're like, Jesus Christ, like, really? Like, it's been 20 years of I'm Like a Bird by Nelly Furtado. Like, what the hell?
Or like when a movie comes out, like, really, The Dark Knight came out, you know, 15 years ago.
Oh my God. I know. Yeah. They're like, oh, we're re-releasing it for the anniversary. And you're like, but that doesn't make any sense because I'm 25.
So what was it about Gawker that drew you to join them? What was the intrigue?
Most high profile writing job you could have.
Sure.
And I definitely thought then, for some reason, that having a huge audience and platform was a necessary precursor to career success and longevity, and that it would ultimately be something that would be great for my career as a writer.
That's no.
I'm like, oh my God.
Visibility is important. Yeah.
Yeah. But actually, Josh, since then, I've had a lot of time to mull it over and also to witness a lot of other young people's careers sort of like start and go all in different directions. Even had the opportunity to mentor people, teach undergraduates, that kind of thing. And one of the things that I've realized, or that I believe now, is that it's actually really bad to have the most attention that you're ever going to get at a moment when, as a writer, you are still figuring it out, finding your voice,
sure.
Figuring out how to do your job, figuring out what you actually believe, who you can trust, what trust even is in that context. Like, I, like most 25-year-olds, thought I knew absolutely everything. I mean, the further away from that moment in my life I get, the more it is continuously revealed to me how little I actually understood anything that I was talking about. Not to say that I didn't do good work and have some of the kind of insights that only young people can have. And I think my first book is full of those. And it's a good book, by the way. It's just like a book of being in your late 20s. And it is definitely best read by someone who is also still in that like part of life, I think. But yeah, that's the one that I see it through now. Like, I'm not saying I was a dum-dum to believe that. Obviously, all of American culture, like, cultures us to believe that being famous is the only way to be, like, seen and known and understood and loved and financially stable. That's why reality shows exist. So it's not on me.
Right.
Entirely.
Right. No, I know what you mean. I even gave you the grimace when you said, you know, that one wouldn't want the high profile position. But as you were explaining it, it makes perfect sense. You want the whatever stardom you want to hit after you've hit maturity and you have, what shall we call it, experience, perspective, something like that.
Yeah. And a moral core. I don't know, frontal cortex fully formed. All would be good things, I guess. But, you know, it's not how it shakes out for many people. And I do think that some people understand it at the beginning, this concept at the beginning of their careers, either because they just innately get it or some kind, wise, older person has taken the time to explain it to them and they've actually been able to hear it.
Right. Yeah. No, I would feel as you do. So you mentioned it. So you became editor-in-chief for Gawker. I believe that would have been, as you said,
I didn't become editor-in-chief of anything. My title was editor, but it really meant something more along the lines of staff writer.
The great research, Josh.
No, this is actually like weirdly obscure that even the Wayback Machine wouldn't necessarily tell you. But at the time when I started working at Gawker, there were no bylines. The whole site was anonymous. And there was a team of writers working on it who, like, real aficionados could sometimes tell people's voices apart and they would indicate that in the comments. So they knew that it was a particular one of the writers whose voice they knew and loved. But it was a team headed up by, at the time that I started, an editor named Chris Mone. And he was taken out to lunch and then he never came back. He was taken out to lunch by Nick Denton and then he did not return from the lunch. A few months into my tenure, and he was replaced by Corey Sika, who had previously worked at the site and returned to it to head up the team of writers.
Gotcha.
So it was me. I was hired at the same time as Dori Shafrir, who went on to write for BuzzFeed and Rolling Stone and write a bunch of books. Corey, as I mentioned, who now, after a stint at Style, editing the Style section of the New York Times, is now back as an editor-in-large at New York Magazine. Alex Balf, a man of mystery. No one knows what he's up to, but I hope he's happy doing whatever that is. And I think that was the team when I first started. And then, like, you know, there was turnover, people left, new people came on, and we started having bylines. I think probably circa when Chris Mone left, although you would have to fact check that, man, I have no idea. Memory hold that along with a lot of other stuff.
Memory hold, that's great. Yeah. Golly, I suppose inevitably we should talk about the Gawker Stalker app. Would that be okay?
Yeah, not an app. Sorry. Yes.
Oh, wait,
I'm already ready to be like, actually, like, yeah, but go ahead. You say what you think Gawker Stalker was, and I will tell you what it actually was.
Yeah, no problem. Well, my understanding was that it was a a program that would basically track the whereabouts of various celebrities, not in real time, but basically, how should I say it? There were citizen journalists that were sort of conscripted into this program that if they see, I think the reference you used was Jude Law shopping at Duane Reade, then that update would then show on the Gawker Stalker app. Do I have that roughly right?
I mean, no, because it wasn't an app. Apps didn't exist. There were no cell phones. This is pre-iPhone era. Yes. It's not pre-social media, but like I wasn't on Facebook until Nick Denton, about halfway through my Gawker tenure in 2007, made all the employees get on Facebook. Just a little side note. So it was just a part of the site. Like it was a, you know, in the whatever, like in the menu, you could like look at the map. The sightings were sent to anonymous tips sent to an email inbox that was checked by interns who would then, whenever they got around to this like intern task that day, post the sightings on the map. So they were not real-time sightings. They would sometimes be several days old. And they were basically like what you see in the first couple of pages of every celebrity tabloid, except for not sent in by publicists.
Mm.
So very innocuous stuff, like not a lot of editorializing. There's more editorializing in one single hour's worth of Des Moines Instagram stories than there like ever was on Gawker Stalker. But I think that the fact that it was called Stalker, I mean, I'm sure whoever made the decision to call it Gawker Stalker was like, haha, it's so cute, it rhymes. But like from our perspective of 2022, we're like, come the on, Stalker? Like, what are we doing here?
Optics, know? Optics.
Yeah, no one was, you know, there was not an HR department, nor was there a PR department at that time. Huh. There's pretty much just the one department of bloggers sitting in a storefront office on Crosby Street, typing away at their laptops. And then there were ad sales guys. And then there were like the tech guys who like made sure the server was working. And that was it. There were probably, at the time that I worked at Gawker, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little like, I think there were probably fewer than 20 employees.
Wow.
Yeah. And we were all paid as independent contractors. Duh. Like we were basically getting paid less than Nick Denton's, you know, dog, like babysitter or whatever. But then we were constantly being hung up out to dry for the sins of this nascent media corporation.
You know, it's interesting.
Angry? Do I sound upset about this? I don't mean to sound upset.
No. You sound exactly the way you should. Yeah, no, not a problem at all. I'm just kind of thinking as you were talking, I think you have it right. If not for the word stalker, it probably would have passed by. Not, you know, who knows? But yeah, I was thinking as you were talking, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I don't know why I used the word application. I don't know what came over me.
That's okay.
What was the, this might be a dumb question. If it is, I can skip it. But can you recall what the general reception of it was originally like?
Oh, it was before I worked at the site. So it was just not something I ever thought about because I didn't have to do any. And none of my work responsibilities had anything to do with it. Ah. It was just part of the site that I worked for.
Like, sure.
So I didn't have any control over it or opinion of it. I don't think I even noticed it, or like I certainly never like went to it and looked at the sighting. Like, who gives a
right?
Like, I mean, you know, I think it's interesting to people who aren't in New York, but if you like live in New York City and you like work in Soho, it's like, oh, Jude Law went to the CVS. Yeah, I just saw Jay-Z and Beyonce like walking down Lafayette. You know, who
right.
cares? But yeah, it was more sort of a, you know, like all tabloid media is to make people who are outsiders feel like insiders. That's like that's how they sell you things and ideas, right?
Sure. Yeah, totally. But yeah, it's like if someone's a features writer at the New York Times and then, you know, they're asked to comment on what the sports people are doing. It's like that's a whole different sort of segment, you know?
I know. I know this one guy, Willie Blackmore, who works at the Times Magazine. Whenever like the Times is getting in trouble for like, I don't know, like making Hillary Clinton lose the election or something, people like come for him and his, you know, Twitter replies. And he's like, guys, it is very hard for me to write every single article that appears in the New York Times every day. But like, don't worry, I got this. Like, I just am going to have some more coffee.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah. So a okay, let's get this over with. I want to get to the money shot of like my, you know, public humiliation moment. And then we can talk about, I don't know, the future of media or whatever.
Sure, sure. Are we on to Jimmy Kimmel then? Or
I guess. I mean, let's, I feel like we should just go for it.
Yeah, with your permission.
I also, for a million percent, have my permission.
All right. So, Emily, you made a memorable appearance, let's call it, on Larry King Live, hosted at the time of Jimmy Kimmel. And it was a panel discussion that was entitled, I think, Do the Paparazzi Go Too Far? You penned an op-ed for the New York Times that goes into the, let's use the phrase, fallout, for lack of a better. And I think I'd like to ask you if there's anything about that panel discussion that you wish you could take back or amend.
Ooh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I've thought a lot about how I would have done the whole thing differently, of course. I didn't understand some very basic tenets of media training then, one of which, of course, is to just talk about whatever the f*** you want and not respond at all to any of the questions, but to be really like appeasing and agreeable while you do it. So you're like, that's a fascinating question, Josh. I love the way you asked that question. And it reminds me of something that a wise man on a safari I once took in Western Africa said to me. And then you just are like off and running. I'm not going to do that to you, Josh. I respect your time too much. But yeah, like I should backtrack a little bit though and say that the way that interview was set up, we were told nothing about what the topic of it would be. And we're not even told that Jimmy Kimmel would be the guest host. It was also done via a remote, like they were in a remote studio. So I was in a room alone in the CNN studios in New York without a monitor. I just had a little bug in my ear. So I could hear them, but I couldn't see their faces. So it was really hard to pick up on sort of the cues about the direction that the conversation was taking, i.e. that it was this gotcha thing that clearly Jimmy Kimmel just wanted to make the point that the Gawker Stacker map should not have posted the sighting of him stumbling around and seeming drunk. I think that especially was really triggering for him because I think he had recently gotten sober maybe. And it was like very, he felt that being perceived as drunk was extraordinarily humiliating. And of course, per him, wildly untrue. And not only was I not prepared for like that specific line of questioning, I wasn't prepared for any line of questioning. And, you know, it's totally flying by the seat of my pants. And that's worth me saying things like, well, aren't celebrities protected by giant piles of money came right from? On the other hand, Josh, this is less true than it used to be. God knows, you know, we've all taken a hit in the last, you know, 15 years financially with all the ups and downs of the market. But aren't celebrities' piles of money still kind of protecting them a bit? Some of them, maybe. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here, but like, sure, isn't someone who is guest hosting Larry King Live in like a slightly better position in terms of being protected by from anything malevolent that could ever happen to him in public than a independent contractor, 25-year-old female journalist publicly living and working in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint specifically,
right,
like not in a doorman building at all. I mean, my only doormen outside of my building in Greenpoint were like the Polish stumble bums who would sometimes pass out in the vestibule and we would have to like rouse them out with some brooms. So it was just kind of a harsh choke to be taken to the cleaners by someone who was clearly punching down in such what felt like such an egregious way. And I was mad and defensive and I reacted from a place of like being really feeling attacked and immediately going on the defensive. And I think if I had the opportunity to talk to Jimmy Kimmel about it now, I would probably listen and try to really empathize and understand what he was actually upset about, which was like feeling like his privacy was violated and that he was, and that he felt unsafe because of the existence of a map that's updated a couple of times a day by interns. And I think once we started to be more like open and honest about the source of the actual tension there, we wouldn't have had to pretend that it was about some larger societal, does the paparazzi go too far? So that was really stuff that he dragged me into that and made me the symbol of it. That's on him for sure. And it still is. He's never reached out, never apologized, never said anything about it publicly. And you know, that's actually because Jimmy Kimmel is like a huge person in our culture and he pops up from everywhere. Like, I literally never know when I'll be in a CVS and there will be like a radio ad with his voice on it. And it actually sucks for me. Like, I still feel really bad every time I see his face or hear his voice.
No, I'm sorry to hear that.
And will for like days afterwards. And that's on PTSD. So thank you, Kimmy Kimmel. It wasn't totally your fault, of course. I think we have to lay some of the blame at the feet of Nick Denton. But I feel like Nick Denton has kind of like taken some hits and has, you know, I mean, he didn't, I don't know. It's weird to have any feelings at all about the demise of Gawker. It shouldn't have gone down the way it did. That was a step and like not a victory for the First Amendment. I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of you.
No problem.
But like at the same time, it was like, you know, it's like the worst person you know is getting like what feels like a karmic comeuppance. It's hard to not feel like a little bit good about it. So,
Schadenfreude.
You know, I try not, like, whatever. It sucks. So it sucks, and it sucks for AJ, who I love. So that sucks. I'm not happy that Gawker is no more, or that Gawker is whatever Gawker is now. I mean, God bless them, but it's not Gawker.
Right. Just one last question there, if you don't mind. I'm actually very curious about this. Are you aware that that interview was parodied on the show Newsroom?
Yes, I actually watched that episode of Newsroom. Wait. Was this in the pilot of Newsroom?
No, it was.
Okay.
It was later on. The ACN Engage, I think it was called.
Oh, yeah. No, that was not at a time. It happened at a time in my life when I was like really not like making a point of not being online. Like I was doing sort of a cleanse phase and like reading books and like touching grass. So I didn't know the specific details of it. Although I did years earlier than that, attend the HBO premiere of the pilot of Newsroom with like all these people from The New Yorker and all of these stars of then famous HBO shows. And I couldn't stand it. I like almost had to get up and leave, even though I was like, you know, looking forward to like having a glass of wine afterwards with like Hendrik Hertzberg or whatever. I hated that show so much. It felt so fundamentally dishonest and so dedicated to like propping up this like dying status quo that like never really existed of like wise old white men who are going to see us through the crises in life and media and government. And like, I don't think anything from that era has aged as badly as the Newsroom. Like that is from Obama era delusional, like we thought that American hegemony would last forever time, you know?
Right.
Oh, well, our bad.
I'm keeping an eye on our time, Emily, so I'll be brief. I would love to maybe talk just a little bit about the end of Gawker. I'll post a thing in the show notes about the Hogan sex tape and so forth. But I'm just curious, were you following the story as it was happening, Emily? And did you have any thoughts?
I kind of wasn't. I mean, I sort of knew the broad strokes outline of it as it was happening, but I was concerned with the outcome only insofar as it affected people who I consider to be friends.
Sure.
Like Corey, like AJ. And so it's like I was coming at it not as like from like a journalistic perspective and more from like a I hope this doesn't wipe out my friend's like, you know, retirement savings perspective. Right. You know. So that was more and I'm kind of the wrong person to ask about that era of Gawker because I stopped reading the site after I worked for it and I like never read it again. So I don't even really know about what eras of Gawker after. Like I would occasionally dip in if there was like something especially great by someone who's violent I really admired. I really liked Hamilton Nolan's work. Maureen O'Connor is a great person who came out of Gawker. Katie Weaver, obviously from Jezebel, Gia Tolentino's superstar. But yeah, I would say that my internet consumption, I mean, I'm a very online person just by nature, but I think it went down a lot after I was no longer working for the internet because I was like, well, I have to write books and also, you know, get married, raise a family, like all that stuff. It's been more top of mind than media gossip lately. Sure. I mean, I'll obviously always care about media gossip, but I'd like talk about it in the group chat, not... in public, because I have learned like something.
Totally.
Hope so.
Let me see. Excellent. Move through quickly. Emily nice. Gould, how can people find out about you?
You go to emilygould.com, man. I finally grasped that URL away from the British milliner who clung to it for like a decade after she stopped using it. So it's mine, EMILGOULD. I always tell people that it's like gold, but with a U. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I refer to my uncle Elliot. He's not actually my uncle, unfortunately.
Elliot Gould.
Yeah. But yeah, it was so fun talking to you. Thanks for being curious about this stuff. I feel like it's kind of a forgotten chapter of internet history, like the lone little standard bearer for like what the internet was like in 2005.
So what's funny is that was my thinking. That was the exact reason why I wanted to talk with you. I find if I can find like cool little, you know, niche pockets of history that people may or may not remember, I just think that's really cool, you know?
I do too. Yeah. I do too. It's a great idea for a podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah, Emily, thank you so much for chatting with me. I enjoyed speaking with you.
Likewise.
I will let you go. I know you got to go, but I really appreciate everything, Emily.
Yeah, let me know when you're going to stick it on the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll send you the published links once that's up.
Cool. All right. Well, have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Emily. You too. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.